Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Well, today I want to talk about the Buddha's last days, months. I've concentrated more and really love the early Buddhist stories. You know, the story of his journey to enlightenment. Also, I talk about his birth once a year, always. Don't spend as much time with his death. But Karen Armstrong has a biography of the Buddha, and she really piqued my interest because she says, according to her, her version of the story is he was kind of melancholy in his last year, last days. The days of the arena, you know, talks were over. And he went traveling with just a very few monks and Ananda, his attendant. So I read up on it, Buddhist books all over the house, biographies of the Buddha. And the one that I took most from was from John Strong, A Brief History of the Buddha, says, or Brief Biography of the Buddha, because he has a lot, refers to a lot of Theravadan stories, the Sanskrit and Pali. So he's 80 at the end. And he, like I said, he embarks on these travels out in the boondocks, not in the cities. And he gives a series of teachings wherever he goes. And the first kind of theme, a theme that he hits over and over again is the Eightfold Path and the three divisions of the Eightfold Path. He really says, don't forget morality. There's three divisions, morality, meditation, and wisdom. And he says, meditation, when it is imbued with morality, brings great fruit. Wisdom, when it is imbued with meditation, brings forth great fruit. And the mind, when it is imbued with wisdom, becomes free from corruptions, from false views, from ignorance. So he really hits that theme. And a lot of his other teachings are of a piece as well, according to me. Just reading them. And they're about how they're going to practice after he's gone and how they should look upon him after, you know, he passes. So his first stop is to visit a man who took over from his father, really took his job. And this king was wondering whether to attack a neighboring territory. And the Buddha says, well, as long as those folks do these seven things, they'll prosper. And he says, seven good things. I don't remember what they are. And so the king starts to think of it from their point of view and decides not to attack. But similarly, the Buddha says, there are seven things that the Sangha is going to need to prosper. I'll read those to you because I think they're kind of neat. It's going to need to hold regular and frequent assemblies like this. It's going to need to meet in harmony, to keep the rules of the training, to honor those who have been ordained before you. It was kind of a strict hierarchy in that way. It didn't matter what your birthplace was, how rich you were, or anything. It was just who came first in the ordination. Don't fall prey to worldly desires. Stay devoted to the forest hermitages and preserve your own personal mindfulness. That's what you'll need. They then visit Shariputra. Actually, they just go to his hometown, and it turns out he's around, so he comes out, talks to the Buddha.
Who is Shariputra?
Shariputra is one of his main disciples.
Okay.
In the Heart Sutra as well. He's the one, by the way, known as the most intellectual one. It's the one that, I think the Buddha's talking to Shariputra on the... No, that's Subhuti, Dhamma Sutra. Anyhow, so... And Shariputra comes out and the Buddha's old, you know, and he just takes the opportunity to praise him and to say, you know, it's clear to me that there is not, there never was, and there never will be an ascetic or a Brahmin who's better or more enlightened than you. Gives him a little love letter. and he says, and the Buddha, rather than just take the compliment, he pushes back and he says, you know, how can you be so sure? how do you know? Don't assume that. So he's telling Shariputra, don't be so certain that you know things. Don't just take them on faith. And also don't lionize me in that way. Then the Buddha takes... I should say there's a number of other little stories that I'm skipping, but after a few more stops, he takes his last retreat, you know, during the rainy season. And it's during a time of famine. And so he doesn't want all the monks to just descend upon one place. So he has them spread out so they don't not a big burden on just one place. And so it's just only him and Ananda totter off somewhere. And it's very hard for the Buddha, and he gets very sick and almost dies there. And Ananda, he says, Ananda, my body's like an old cart, just held together with straps. But he doesn't want to die there because he wants to die with it, with everybody, not just with Ananda. So he rallies, and Ananda, after he rallies, says he's happy because, among other reasons, because the Buddha hasn't yet made a successor, and he's hoping that's going to happen. So this was just great. I'd never heard this before. He tells Ananda, no, he says, I'm not a closed fist teacher. That's the way he puts it. Who holds back some special teaching to confer upon the one, or to give an esoteric final teaching to the chosen one. He says, I don't work that way. I just give it to anybody. And no monk, he says, I give my Dharma to all. No monk has some special authority. He says, anybody who can work hard can achieve awakening. You know, I can't help but notice how different that is, how there is at least a shade of difference between that and the Zen tradition, which is very much about kind of mind-to-mind transmission and kind of the special teaching that is passed down in what can seem quite an esoteric way. I wonder now, in this age, whether we're moving away from that and maybe back more toward this swinging back toward a less closed fist approach. I think about that with my teacher who didn't make a successor and who, you know, from my point of view, made a number of messes, including that. But he was intentional about it too. He said, I remember once, you know, don't worry about it. We asked him, who's going to teach after you? Don't worry about it, he said. Son, you all will grow up. It is a worry, actually, in our school, that kind of thing, when that doesn't happen. But I think about the Dalai Lama, too. Just recently, I think he said, you know, I might be the last one of this special lineage. We might have to do things differently. So that's this was interesting for me to read. The Buddha then very famously... Well, okay, so he's been sick. And there's this blacksmith. His name is Kunda. And the Buddha gets together back together with his monks, and this Kunda makes a special meal, which he thinks is going to be medicine for the Buddha. And I've never heard this quite like this. He thinks it's going to be medicine for the Buddha, and it's called Pig's Delight. So there's been lots of ink spilled over whether it was the Buddha eating pig, pork? Or was it mushrooms, because pigs love mushrooms? It's not clear what it was, but it seems that the Buddha was not a vegetarian, I won't get into that. Anyhow, so he eats it, and he gets really sick, and he's so concerned, he mentions it many times. Don't blame Kunda. It's not his fault. He was just trying to get... It's just that the medicine wasn't strong enough. Mm-hmm. I was already sick. He's very concerned about that. And so finally he lies down between two sala trees, pointed toward the north, a famous, you know, lying down like this. And the death pose. And he says, it may be that after I'm gone, that some of you will think, you know, now we have no teacher. But this is not how you should see it. Let the Dharma and the discipline, the precepts that I have taught you be your teacher. Behold, monks, my last advice to you is, all things pass away. Strive on diligently. Sometimes all of that is just... into be a lamp unto yourself. It's up to you now. I'm gone. All things pass. Now it's up to you. In our practice, this really is a key point that that you can do it without relying on the magnetic power of the Buddha. You can do it. But also... you must do it. You have to do it. It's not just that you can do it, it's you must do it. You must take this on yourself. You must know it for yourself. You have to take it on vigorously, not just learn it from books or from teachers or from fellow travelers. All those things are important. But you have to do the work yourself. And you have to get to know yourself, your own self. Not some concepts, but your own self. And you have to test this path. And fundamentally, you have to find your own path. That's something I really appreciate about Buddhism. And it's kind of almost a truism, but I really want to emphasize that you and I, we have to seriously examine ourselves and not just take it from the tradition. We have to really, what's the word I'm looking for, with vigor do that. When I first went to Mount Baldy Zen Center, Everything was taken care of. I was told all what to do at every second, it seemed like. All of, you know, you march here and you go here and this is when you go to the bathroom. And this is when you eat and this is how you eat. But after a while I thought, they forgot to tell me one thing, which is just how to do this practice inside. So everything on the outside was taken care of, but the inside was not taken care of. And not only that, it was really not taken care of. I mean, it was wide open, it felt to me. There was very little help, even from the Roshi, you know, who would say, you know, I mean, various things, but they added up to there. You can find the other shore, and it's really nice there. So go find it. It's really wonderful. Ah, the full moon in the sky. I used to say together with him, ah, the full moon in the sky. Wonderful. As if I found it. Wonderful. Wonderful. So I felt, you know, there I was sitting and sitting. I felt like I'd been dropped in the middle of a forest. And I just was sitting my way through the thicket of myself, searching, looking for a clearing, trying to listen for the river. And when we do it that way, we have to be resourceful, we have to be creative, we have to learn to be creative, because my options are limited on the inside. But on the inside, on the outside, but on the inside, I have to find my way by myself. And I think we learn to map our inner landscape that way. If somebody had made the path for me to the river, to the other shore, I would have gotten to know that path. And I would have been afraid of the woods. So I think there is really something to getting dropped and to telling you, all right, you figure it out now. And you're going to bump around and you're going to get scratched up, but you're going to get to know the woods, you're going to get to know the landscape. And you're going to have to learn to be resourceful. Not just know one path. I think we teachers can help a lot, but we are mostly a coach. You know, we can help you with some techniques, I think. Tell you some things that we've seen along the way. But a lot of our job also as a coach is a cheerleader. You know, keep it up, keep going, you'll get there. Don't give up. It's worth it. You can do it, and you must do it. So, I feel like resourcefulness, this story of the Buddha's last words, are kind of a pointing us in the direction of knowing that resourcefulness, our own resourcefulness, is a spiritual quality. Master Rinzai, many years later, picks up on this theme of do it yourself, that you can't rely on others, and it comes up over and over again in Zen. You can't rely on those great old masters. You have to develop, and he says, a faith in yourself. And over and over, he hits that theme. Don't just rely on the great teachers of old and the trappings of the tradition. When you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. When you meet the old ancestors, kill the ancestors. And here's a quote from him. It's only because you lack confidence in yourself that you're looking for something outside of you. We develop that confidence in ourselves by really getting to know ourselves. And Rinzai was also, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this quite a bit, most of the way through his commentary on Rinzai Rokpu. He makes a big thing about how Rinzai was always talking about himself as a friend on the path, not this high and mighty teacher, but a spiritual friend. So, yeah. The last thing I want to say about this is that it might seem obvious now, maybe in our culture, that we have to do it ourselves. We're kind of used to doing it ourselves. We take a little bit from here, we take a little bit from there, we make our own practice. You know, Rinzai was talking about it in the context of a big structure. And what I'd like to leave you with is I want to encourage you to take this other part of the Buddha's last words, to really strive, diligently and inside. Because I think you and I have to honestly do this work. In our times, I think it's easy to get advice from different places, to read all kinds of things and kind of put on lots of clothes. It's harder to really get quiet and really quietly examine ourselves and quietly do the serious work of getting to know ourselves and getting to know zero. I don't know how it was 300 years ago, but these devices that we have and all the technology that we have, I think can maybe make us more outwardly focused. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to travel outwardly, you know, we have so much freedom to go here and to go there. And I think maybe our challenge is to cut that off temporarily and stop moving out, and the latest thing is commenting on everything. We've become such great commenters. I could comment everywhere. I comment, there's a comment section everywhere, and Facebook is commenting on this and that and the other. So there's just so much commentary. I think it's less easy to, so it's so easy to have an opinion and to share that opinion with everybody. And it's less easy just to shut up. Sorry, I shouldn't put it so strongly. But just to be quiet and to not comment. And, yeah, so that, to fight that reflex in a certain way. And, you know, the great example of that is just in the Zendo. When we're sitting there and somebody's moving around a lot, or farting, or something, and it's annoying, and we have a tendency, I do, you know, I have to comment and comment and comment on that thing, and wish it would go away. And the joy of practice, the real resourcefulness, is learning to take that in, whatever that noise is, to make that part of your meditation, to make that part of your journey to zero. That's the real resourcefulness. And in a certain way, if we're always moving all the time, we don't learn that resourcefulness, that kind of resourcefulness. That, and we don't learn that power. Because I think it's actually a kind of power that we're not... Rinzai says, bound up with... slave to favorable circumstances. Yeah, so the... And somewhere I read in the Buddhist tradition, there is this idea of turning your lamp around. So not always going out, looking out, but turning it around and looking inward. That's been meaningful for me. So the Buddha's message at the end of his life was that nobody can do it for you, that no technology, no books, no teacher in the end can do it. That you must do it yourself. One of my favorite Ikkyu poems is, I'll leave you with this, I'd love to give you something, but what would help?
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.